it's not something that somebody has control over. Mm-hmm. It's almost like asking somebody to stop breathing.
It's not just stop your substance, life will be better. You know, it's not about that. There is so much more to it.
You know, I've ever spoken with a close friend or family member who let me know they had a new or problematic medical condition that was life-changing that I didn't hug and tell them that I was sorry and ask if I could help.
Welcome to episode 5 of Debunked, the only Utah podcast combining evidence-based health practices with storytelling to challenge the stereotypes and debunk the myths about harm reduction, opioids, and substance use disorders. I'm Tim Light, and today we will be discussing the myth that addiction can be cured if you have enough willpower. In this conversation, we'll talk about how addiction is a chronic illness. We'll talk about medication for addiction treatment, or MAT, which in the last couple of weeks was changed by the American Society of Addiction Medicine from medication-assisted treatment, or MAT, to medication for addiction treatment with the same acronym of MAT. We'll also hear stories about personal journeys of healing and about some of the key components to those journeys. And then we'll end with compassion, because harm reduction is all about compassion.
My name is Michelle Chapuse. I am from Fort Duchesne. I'm a member of the Ute Indian Tribe, Uncompahgre Band. I'm a drug and alcohol counselor. I'm a substance use disorder counselor. Uh-huh. Let me correct myself on that. I've been working in the field for approximately 10 years, and I love it. And I've been working with USU for about a year now, a year. Yeah. So I work with the tribal communities throughout the state of Utah, just doing opioid education and Narcan and naloxone training. That's me.
Michelle's the queen. She's so good at what she does.
Yeah. Why, thank you.
And then we have Dr. Green.
Hello. My name's Patrick Green. I'm a family practice physician in Tooele, Utah. I have a clinic there. We treat everything from babies to our older adults, and we do quite a bit of substance abuse treatment, something that I've been doing for about the past 14 years in addition to primary care.
All right, Adam, you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. So my name's Adam Baxter. I'm a person in long-term recovery.
Great.
I just celebrated my 4th year sobriety birthday.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congrats.
I work at US Magnesium. It's an industrial chemical plant, and I volunteer as a chapter lead for Young People in Recovery, Tooele County chapter, in my spare time.
Very cool.
Awesome.
What is Young People in Recovery?
So it's a national nonprofit organization. It provides recovery resource support services, basically.
Okay.
So we organize events each month for people in recovery to show them how to live clean and have fun doing it. We give them life skills training and a structured all recovery meeting each week.
Wow. Cool. Every week you guys meet.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's awesome. That's way awesome.
Young people in recovery, is it like adolescents or is it kind of just...
It's anybody.
Anybody?
Okay. Yeah. It's called Young People in Recovery because it was started by young people in recovery for young people.
But okay.
It's grown into quite a large thing.
And it's still called Young People in Recovery to make everyone feel young, even if they're not.
Yes.
Kind of deal. Okay. Sounds good. Cool. Well, today, like I said, we're talking about the myth addiction can be cured by willpower. And maybe we should talk about it in terms of, like, people often say, you know, you just need to try a little harder. And if you just try a little harder, you can get over this. You know, you can overcome this addiction if you just try a little harder. Adam, what do you think about that when you hear that myth, when you hear the terms, you know, like, just try a little harder, you can get over this?
You know, for some people that's doable, you know, just trying a little bit harder. For an addict like myself, I tried a lot of different things to try and stay clean, moving different states, hanging out with different people. But I couldn't do it on my own.
What was key for you then?
Finding a support system and a relationship with a higher power was key, because I didn't have that.
Wow. So, like, more than young people in recovery, or was that the type of support system that you found?
So I actually got my start in recovery with a 12-step program. So that's that's my foundation.
Very cool. So, Dr. Green, what do you think about that myth when you hear addiction can be cured by willpower?
I think it's clearly false.
Yeah.
I don't think that we would see as much suffering, pain, death, loss if it was something that was as easy as just trying harder.
Yeah.
But we also are starting to gather quite a bit of scientific evidence that shows us some of the changes that happen with addiction and long-term substance abuse, mm-hmm. and why it may be harder than just willpower alone.
What do you mean by changes when you say changes?
Well, so we can, with research and imaging now, more clearly define changes in the brain and body that occur with long-term substance abuse, really regardless of the substance that's being abused. Once those changes occur, they drive a lot of behaviors and what we would consider choices on a subconscious level. So it's not something that somebody has control over. Mm-hmm. It's almost like asking somebody to stop breathing. It's not something that they can quite easily do.
Wow. That's really profound. It's almost like breathing. It's like something, it becomes something that your body needs, right?
It really does. We know there's certain areas of the brain that change in shape and function, and those areas are key to the choices and behaviors that we do throughout our daily life.
Yeah.
So part of our brain that decides what importance different things should have inappropriately assigns the maximum level of importance to substance abuse. Mm-hmm. And so if your brain on a very deep or subconscious level believes that substance use is the most important thing to survival, you find yourself letting everything else slip, your home, your family, your job. I don't think that there's anybody who wants to live some of the lives that we see or hear about out of choice.
Yeah.
Other parts of the brain that are in charge of experiencing pleasure don't work appropriately. And so nothing else really feels pleasurable unless you're continuing to use substances.
Yeah.
And then the part of our brain that's in charge of planning, setting goals, willingness and awareness to do something that may be painful now so that we can have pleasure in the future gets disconnected from the rest of the brain. So if you have a brain that believes substance use is the most important thing, that can't feel pleasure without substance use, feels pain to the point of physical illness if you go without substance use, and then is not able to use the part of the brain that is involved with reason, you can't ask somebody to just try harder or to make a choice. It's really almost physically impossible for them to do that in the circumstance.
Yeah. It's become a disease at that point. It really is a disease. Yeah.
Any chronic disease involves change in function of some organ.
Yeah.
In this case, it's the brain. And I think that
that's probably the most important
definition
organ
of chronic disease. Yeah.
Yeah. Gosh, thanks.
Okay, before we get too much further into this episode, we wanted to give Dr. Aaron Fanning Madden, who is our science advisor, a few minutes to present an objective perspective, sort of from a bird's eye view, on the topics that we covered in this conversation.
In this episode, you will hear about treatment interventions, including medications for addiction treatment, like methadone and buprenorphine. And you're also going to hear about peer support programs and the most common form of these programs that exists in the U.S., which is Alcoholics Anonymous, or AA, and Narcotics Anonymous, or NA. There is a lot of tension between Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous and people who work with medications for addiction treatment. Many AA and NA groups discourage people from using these medications and will even say that a person cannot be in the group while they are using the medications because many people who are involved in AA and NA consider these medications as comparable to using illicit opioids like heroin. On this podcast today, you're going to hear people who have been helped by NA and AA, as well as a physician who works in medication treatment. Despite a long history of tension between people who do medication treatment, as well as people who work in harm reduction, and those people who are involved in AA and NA, you're gonna hear people actually agreeing on many concepts related to addiction. And both of these approaches, the sort of abstinent-based AA and NA approach that says, you know, you have to stop all drug use, including these medications to treat your addiction. Sort of that approach and the approach that says you should be treating this condition, your addiction condition, as a medical illness, and thus medications are appropriate to treat medical illnesses if they're available. Both of those approaches are seeking to help people, and both are trying to save lives. And what we're going to hear in today's podcast is ways in which those goals are shared by people who have an NA and AA piece in their recovery and people who work in medication treatment. Peer support is actually not just a feature of AA and NA. It is useful for people who are not necessarily spiritual or religious, because AA and NA do have a strong spiritual religious component. Peer support is also offered in other sorts of treatment programs for people who are not interested in the religious component. And it is an evidence-based practice to receive some kinds of social support from people who also have an addiction or have had an addiction in their past. So research has shown that peer support can help, for example, to reduce rehospitalization due to drug use. So this is a science-based solution, but peer support is not a replacement for help from trained professionals. So science-based solutions that include things like medications, as well as specific counseling or talk therapy approaches, like cognitive behavioral therapy, people still need those even when they are going to peer support programs. Because when you get peer support, you're not necessarily getting help from a trained medical professional who is using science-based approaches to help someone in their recovery. So in today's podcast, we're hoping to bridge conversations between people who have a lot of experience in Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, and those who are working in medication treatment, as well as those who are working in harm reduction services. We do want to honor the stories of people who have been helped by AA and NA, while recognizing that some of the messages that are commonly used in AA and NA groups can be harmful and are not evidence-based. So for example, as I said earlier, many AA and NA groups think the use of medications for addiction treatment is not acceptable. However, the American Society of Addiction Medicine, the American Medical Association, considers these medications the first line of care and essential care for people who have opioid use disorders and alcohol use disorders. Currently, such medications do not really exist for other types of addictions, such as cocaine use disorders, though there is some promising research that means that maybe we will have these medications someday. And I just want to read a quote from someone who works in harm reduction about their experience with NA and AA. So this is a person who is a harm reduction practitioner in Austin, Texas, and he said, "The 12-step fellowship saved my life. But in that fellowship, we probably kill more people than we help. I have a friend that was told by a gentleman in AA that he would only sponsor my friend if he got off methadone in 6 months. My friend did it and relapsed within 7 days and died." So I think it's really important that we hold NA and AA to the standard of science while also recognizing the significant good that they have done in a lot of people's lives.
I want to go back to something Dr. Green just said about nobody wants, you know, to be living a life where maybe substance use becomes that substance is a thing that they need, and other things might fall to the side. Adam, what do you think about that?
I think it's definitely true. My drug of choice was heroin, which I used IV, and it got to the point where I had to have that waking up just to feel okay for the day. And at that point, it's your whole life revolves around it.
Like, did you have your family at that time and stuff?
Yeah, but I was completely disconnected from them. Yeah. The drug was more important than anything.
Yeah.
It's not the lifestyle I wanted, but my body needed it.
Yeah, yeah. Michelle, how have you seen this play out in your career as a substance use disorder
counselor? First off, I just want to say, man, you guys totally debunked this whole myth with that statement.
Should we just be done?
We just hit it right on the nail on the head.
Yeah.
So what I love about what they're saying, everybody is saying, is that in the drug and alcohol field, when you're working with somebody, nobody wants, like we talked about in the last episode, kind of this whole moral lens that comes over. Yeah. Nobody wants to feel like they are incapable of choosing a better life or mm-hmm. doing something different. You know, so there's just this big old, you know, misconception that I can be smarter. It's like when you play a game, you know, you have to know the rules.
Yeah.
And in order to advance in the game, uh-huh. you have to know how the game works and how the rules go. And so with recovery, from what I found from my own personal experience, is that understand what is going on. Then all of a sudden this sheet of moral, like, there's something wrong with me mm-hmm. morally, you know, mm-hmm. why can't I choose my family? Mm-hmm. Why can't, or when people look at you like, why can't you do this or this and that?
So like when in the context of somebody using, like if they relapse or something and yeah. they say, why did I relapse? Like, why did I choose this over all these other things that I'm putting in my life that I think, that I know are better than me relapsing? Is yep. that what you're talking about?
Yes,
here?
Exactly. Yeah. And then what comes in is guilt, shame, yeah. Yeah. you know, and we all know that those emotions and those feelings perpetuate substance use.
Yeah.
Because if you're feeling like you're crap, then it's like, I'm not worth this. Mm-hmm. I can't do this. Then you hear, you know, the disparities coming in. And so, you know, if we look at like with the harm reduction components, if we understand that our body is experiencing what it's experiencing yeah. because of what opioids do, and it's hijacking the way, you know, we connect with the people that we love or mm-hmm. those things that identify us as an individual. Once we recognize that, okay, I need to be able to think clearly, but I need to stop my substance.
Yeah.
But in order to do that, I have to take the first step of being able to function, because I know what my substance does to my body
yeah.
when I stop taking it. You know, these little steps. I think sometimes people feel that there's a huge misconception that recovery is this destination. You know, it's like all of a sudden, you know, you pass go, you collect $200, bam, you've got it. Mm-hmm. You know, I've completed a 65-day program, so on and so forth. But the reality is, it's a continual journey. We've got to be able to recognize that there are going to be instances, because of what it does to our body physically, where we need to make adjustments. Mm-hmm. So let's say we're going down one path and one method, a self-help group.
Yeah.
Let's say like NA. And all of a sudden that just stops working for us. We can't, yeah. you know, for whatever reason. Then it's like, okay, what is it that I need? Mm-hmm. What is it that's going to help me move forward? So it's a continual thing. It's not just about, well, you have to work. You know, recovery is about working. I mean, I think we all know that, right?
But it's not just about
your willpower.
Yeah.
And so if we're so stuck on ourselves and that we have the ability, you know, so egocentric, yeah. it's like, yeah, I can defeat this. Right. But then when you fail, all of a sudden it's like, I failed.
Yeah.
And so I love how you talked about with your higher power, because that is such a
how
key
Adam
component.
About
yes.
Power. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a tendency to pointing at people and not like saying their names.
That's okay. That's okay.
But to be able to surrendering is so key. You know?
I think that's interesting, because even if we just talk about like the physiology of addiction, we can still surrender to the knowledge that we have that this is a disease, that it's changed, it's changed somebody's brain, and now the neural pathways and things are changed, and so they have to surrender to that knowledge so that they can get treatment, right?
Yes.
And I think the beautiful thing about, you know, this podcast is geared towards harm reduction. And last episode, we talk about how harm reduction is compassion. So if you're being compassionate to somebody, that's a form of harm reduction. I think we can go and we can say, you know, when we're taking different forms of treatment as well, we can almost consider those. I mean, we should consider those harm reduction, like going to a group and making sure you have a good support system. You know, we talk also a lot about medication-assisted treatment as harm reduction, which I think is like, you know, getting to what Michelle was saying and doing the things that you need to do in order to, you know.
Yeah, to help you be successful in your recovery.
Yeah.
But then even if there is a person that does, you know, maybe they falter and they reuse, it's like, okay, let's find out what happened. Let's map the experience. Mm-hmm. What were the triggers? What was the environment? Now let's come up with a safety plan. What can we do? What can I do to help you figure out, okay, this environment does not work for me. But maybe it wasn't the environment, maybe it was the emotion. And the emotion is the one that drove the unmanageability from the situation that led to the distraction.
Yeah.
So you can see it's just this huge dynamic dance.
Yeah.
It's not just about try harder.
Yeah.
There's so much more to it.
Oftentimes it's not even anything very significant that started the relapse process. Mm. Once you have the neural pathways in place, anything really can start that. And it kind of comes down to the idea of conditioning. If you are exposed to the same things in the presence of a reward repeatedly,
yeah.
your brain starts to associate those things with that reward. And so it could be a smell, a song, a person, a place, an emotion, a time of year, a thousand little things.
Yeah.
And next time that you're exposed to one of those triggers that you've conditioned your brain to, mm-hmm. it starts that process of anticipation, excitement, desire, craving, and thinking about relapsing. And if you don't have any way to shut that process down, then it will eventually result in
a relapse.
A relapse, yeah.
yeah.
And so I think it's really important that people start to understand it's something you've conditioned your brain to do, which our brain is very good at.
Mm-hmm.
And just like you inadvertently conditioned it the first time, you can recondition those triggers to other positive or negative rewards, or you can work with a therapist to weaken their effect. But once we know what
like
they are,
the
we can address
and
them.
Stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just having the understanding of what's happening inside of your body and your brain oftentimes gives people the power to stop that process. It's no longer something that they feel like is out of their control or inevitable. It's something they can almost picture, you know, a circuit laid out on the floor where if you push this button, this light turns on.
Yeah.
If you just stop pushing the button, the light will turn off and you can let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And it can have pretty dramatic impacts for people just to learn and understand what's happening.
Yeah. Adam, can you pinpoint a time when, you know, you kind of saw this play out in your recovery, what Dr. Green was talking about?
Yeah, definitely early on in my recovery, I used a lot in Tooele County.
Uh-huh.
So anywhere I went, seeing people in the store, you know, there were a lot of things that could trigger
okay.
that urge or desire for the drugs. It probably didn't help that I sold drugs to use drugs. So
yeah,
it was everywhere. Mm-hmm. But a big part of the program that I was involved in was you had to change everything in order to keep your recovery. So that's what I ended up doing. I stopped going to certain places, stopped hanging out with certain family or friends,
mm-hmm.
and stopped doing the things that I was doing so I could move past them, like he was saying, yeah.
Was that hard?
It is, and I pride myself on showing people that it is possible to do that where you live, because it's very difficult to do, and yeah. I like to show people every day that it's possible.
Yeah. So, and thanks for both Dr. Green and Adam for sharing that, and Michelle.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and after the break, we'll talk about medication for addiction treatment. So we'll be right back. The Debunked Podcast is made possible by our members, and USU's Department of Kinesiology and Health Science is committed to educating and serving students and members of both local and extended communities in the fields of kinesiology and health science. Information at khs.usu.edu. And the Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services, committed to quality teaching, outreach, and research, offering services to the community and providing students with real-world service and research opportunities. Information at cehs.usu.edu. Welcome back to Debunked. The myth that we are debunking today is addiction can be cured if you have enough willpower. Earlier on the show, we talked about how addiction is a chronic illness, thus it cannot be cured by willpower alone. Now we're going to jump into talking a bit about medication for addiction treatment, or MAT.
In talking about harm reduction, sometimes, like I said, we talk about medication-assisted treatment. Dr. Green, do you guys, at your clinic, do you
We use a lot of medicines.
You do? Okay.
Just before I started the clinic that I'm at now, I was the medical director for a methadone clinic here in Salt Lake City for a few years. When I opened a clinic in Tooele, I gave up my capacity as the medical director, but I continue to use a number of different medications depending on what substance abuse disorder we're treating.
Yeah. Sometimes we hear people say that, you know, you shouldn't, that medicated assisted treatment isn't actually, like air quotes, being clean. It's not actually being substance free. What are your thoughts on that?
I disagree with that. I think there's a couple of different ways to view it. But if we accept the idea that substance abuse is a chronic disease, meaning that it has changed the form and function of organ or a system in our body, there's medications that can help. And any other illness that we treat, we're willing to use medications to try and restore a more normal level of function.
Right.
So I don't have a problem using medications. Usually when we're talking about medication-assisted treatment, we're talking about opiate dependence in particular and the use of either methadone or buprenorphine.
Right.
And those medications are absolutely life-saving. Not only have they been shown to reduce the transmission of hepatitis, HIV, reduce overdose deaths and injury, but they allow us to control some of the harder aspects of recovery. Mm-hmm. Often in the beginning, like Adam mentioned, you're looking at the prospect of changing your whole life.
Yeah. Which, I mean, we can just pause. I'm sorry to interrupt your thought. That's so heavy. Change your whole life.
It's huge.
I mean, think about, I'm not going to see my best friend or some of my family members, and like I might need to move. I mean, can we all please just accept how incredibly heavy that is, right?
It is an extremely daunting and overwhelming prospect at the beginning of recovery. And we can postpone some of the things until later with the use of medications like methadone and buprenorphine. We can stop the process of physical withdrawal symptoms. We can stabilize a lot of the neuropathways and changes in the brain that need to heal. And then we can deal with them later once we have a good social network in place, we have employment in place, and we have a lot of the other support networks in place. Not to mention, you know, hopefully months of sobriety.
Yeah. So those medications are a tool.
Very,
that we
very
can
much
use
so.
Almost like to restabilize.
Yeah.
And get, you know, to move into those other aspects of recovery.
I think the other important distinction is when used appropriately, there's no euphoria or high from the use of buprenorphine or methadone.
Can you repeat that one more time?
Yeah, there's no euphoria or high when used appropriately with methadone or buprenorphine.
So when used appropriately, people are not getting high from using methadone or buprenorphine.
And with buprenorphine, if you're using it at the recommended doses, it blocks the effect of pain medications and heroin. So if you do have a relapse, you don't experience the euphoria or the high from the substance of abuse, which can be huge, right? It keeps one slip up from turning into a week or another year or an overdose.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the medications are invaluable tools when it comes to recovery.
That's a perfect definition of harm reduction right there.
Yeah.
It, you know, it prevents one slip up from becoming a week or a week of using or an overdose that might result in somebody dying. That's also like so profound, right?
So just a quick side note, everybody in the room is shaking their head in agreeance. I know nobody can see that, but we're all like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The medication's not the only way.
No.
And it's not for everybody, right? And it's just like if somebody comes into my office with diabetes, we tailor the treatment to them. And there's different medicines that we choose under different circumstances. Mm-hmm. And some people may be able to control and enter remission from their diabetes with changes in diet and exercise. And I think that's fantastic.
Right.
So it's all about trying to figure out what everybody's individual goals are, what their beliefs are, and what's going to work the best for them.
Yeah.
Which makes treating substance abuse in primary care so wonderful.
Yeah.
Because we don't approach other diseases like most people approach substance abuse treatment.
Mm-hmm.
If I have someone come into my office with high blood pressure and we take their blood pressure at the beginning of a visit and they're above 140 over 90, I don't kick them out of my office.
Yeah.
I don't take their medicine away and I don't shame them in the street. And so we don't do that with our patients for substance abuse either. We encourage them to come whenever they can or need to come.
Yeah.
If they have a relapse or if for some reason they fall out of treatment, we encourage them to come back and try again.
Of course.
And we try our best to treat the big picture. So we focus a lot on having healthy relationships, making sure that we understand other physical or psychiatric issues that we need to be addressing. And we try very hard to do it all in a setting that would be the same as it would be for any other chronic illness.
Yeah. So I love comparing, well, I love saying that addiction is a disease because it is. You know, I love your comparison about diabetes. My dad is a type 1 diabetic, and it's laughable if I were to say, Dad, you know, like, you can be cured from your diabetes if you just try harder.
Right. It's impossible.
Because he is insulin dependent. He has to have insulin or he will die. Since he was 17 years old, that's how it's been. So, I mean, that's what do you think, Adam, when you hear somebody acknowledge that an addiction is a disease and, you know, and it's something like it's like any other disease and it should be treated that way. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. And your analogy there with diabetes was spot on. You know, you can't try harder to be free of diabetes. You have to be insulated. You know, you have to have that insulin.
Yeah. And it's a, and it's, you know, it's like a, it's something you just live with and you're treated and you live your life in a way that manages your disease, right? Like any other chronic illness.
That's right. You try to optimize your diet. You try to optimize your physical health, your exercise, your sleep. You try to optimize your relationships. You try to make sure that you have purpose in life. You have a job that you hopefully enjoy.
Are you talking about if you have an addiction, this is what you do?
This is what we do for with life, right? This, if you come to the doctor and you're suffering from any chronic illness, it doesn't matter if it's depression, anxiety, diabetes, hypertension, opiate dependence, alcohol dependence, really the treatment should be the same, right? We should look at your life and try to start making decisions that improve your chances of health and happiness.
Okay, I just have to say really quick, I thought you were, for a second, I thought you were talking about diabetes still. And so it was this beautiful moment of clarity when I thought, oh, maybe he's talking about addiction.
Both.
Yeah. I mean, they're both chronic illnesses, you know, that take this treatment in order to be, you know, healthy.
Correct. And if you look at different models of substance abuse treatment, there's two programs that tend to work very well, and we use them for pilots and for physicians. And they have...
For pilots and physicians?
They have kind of their own treatment programs. The pilots program is, I don't know if it's funded by the FAA or who funds it. Physicians are usually run by the state medical board, and their treatment is really primary care. They have a doctor who will do an evaluation and try to define the problem, recommend treatments, whether they're in their clinic or outside of their clinic, and then just follow up and make sure that those things are happening and that they're getting the result that they want. And more importantly, that follow-up and those treatments continue presumably indefinitely. Down the road, it may be less intense than it was in the beginning, but once you find a treatment plan that's working for that person, it's just a matter of continuing what works.
Yeah.
It's not one instance of treatment that lasts for 90 days and then you graduate and you're done.
Yeah.
It's long-term treatment, just like we would approach any other chronic disease.
Yeah.
We have to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll hear about Adam's story and some of the keys to his healing journey. We'll also talk about how others can support people who are on a healing journey. Be right back. The Debunked Podcast is made possible by our members and the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration Rural Opioid Technical Assistance Program, offering programs to address barriers of access to rural communities related to opioid use disorder. And Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield of Utah works to transform healthcare from the inside out. We reduce confusion, waste, and red tape for members as we help them navigate the healthcare system. Welcome back to Debunked. The myth that we are debunking today is addiction can be cured if you have enough willpower.
So, Adam, what has been, you talked a little bit about what has been key for you in long-term recovery. Can you tell us that, you know, the important things for you in long-term recovery to keep going with this recovery and stay healthy?
Definitely. Self-care is a big part of it. You know, as Dr. Green pointed out, like your physical well-being. So I try to work out whenever I can outside of work. My work is also physically demanding. So self-care is huge. I feel that service work, like giving back, that's why I do what I do with YPR, is recovery was given to me freely, so I have to give that back in order to keep it. Mm-hmm. And then just keeping the support system in place, I met my wife in a 12-step meeting. We work on recovery together, but we have a separate program. So yeah, those are three key things for me, plus the relationship with my higher power. It's huge because I couldn't do it by myself. Uh-huh. I tried a lot of different ways, and my ways wound up with a needle in my arm or in jail or back in that sick state every day. So
right. So the important thing, I think, from what you're saying, Adam, is that it wasn't just willpower. You know, it was all these other things, right?
That it definitely wasn't willpower. It's his will for me.
Yeah. Thanks.
So Adam just told us some of the important keys in his healing journey. We want to know what works for you in your healing journey. So we invite our listeners, you, to send in short audio or video recordings of things that are key to your healing journey. Phone recordings will work great. You can send your recording to our email, debunkedcast@gmail.com, or message us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter @debunkedpod.
Michelle, what are you thinking? I see you grinning over
here. I'm just sitting here thinking, this is so amazing. I love this conversation because it's about the totality of it all. It's not just stop your substance, life will be better. You know, it's not about that. There is so much more to it. It's about nutrition. How can your body heal if it's not getting the right nutrients, minerals, proteins to be able to have the body work the way it needs to work to find healing?
Yeah.
It's like, how can you, if you're disconnected from a support group, how do you find, you know, that connection? We're humans, we have to have connection. And so if we have no connection, it just perpetuates, right?
Yeah.
Sleep is key. The body needs to have rest.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not just this, I'm going to stop my substance and then I'm going to, you know, then everything's going to be great. Everything's going to go back to what it needs to be. It's that there's more to it. There is more to you as an individual, whether it's through your spirituality, whether it's through a MAP program, whatever it may be, it is about your individual journey and what's going to help you to get the goals and meet and to achieve what you're wanting to achieve. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's awesome. I totally love it. It's just like, you know, this whole conversation is about people understanding. And the more you understand about that, the more empowered you are to make decisions that are going to help you to move forward.
Yeah.
And so, so sometimes we get so stuck on it, just stop the substance. Just stop.
So there's, you know, I hear lots and lots of stories of family members who they themselves are not using, but they have a person in their life that they love a lot who is using and maybe an active addiction, and they feel helpless, you know. And oftentimes, it's like this gamut of emotion, but like it's, you know, a relapse happens or their person is out on the street using, and then they're angry and they just say, I just want them to stop. Like, I want them to try harder. Like, what would you tell somebody if they came to you and said that?
We have this discussion a lot. And I think the important thing you touched on at the very beginning, which is compassion. Most of us, you know, we would not kick a family member out or have a formal and painful intervention mm-hmm. if we had, you know, a father with diabetes who was not controlling their diabetes. But we were watching them suffer, and it brought us a lot of grief to see them have, you know, amputated limbs, heart attacks, mm-hmm. kidney failure, loss of vision. You know, we would approach that with a different type of reaction than we would if we had a family member who was suffering equally severe outcomes with substance abuse.
Yeah.
And so I think the conversation really should be, hey, listen, I love you. And I can see that you're having a hard time right now. And I worry that it's out of your control. And I want you to know that I'm here for you. If I can do anything to help, I want to help.
Yeah.
Instead of what happens far too often, which is, if you're going to use drugs, you need to leave.
Gosh, that like makes me emotional.
It is. It's when people disconnect, you know, because it's like they're frustrated. You know, they're frustrated of what's happening. They themselves may not have the skills to understand how to communicate properly. how to, you know, we've got all these, you know, because we've got our own issues, right? And if we have
the family members, so you're talking family members.
Yeah, family members. Yeah. So if we have somebody in our family that is actively using or is, you know, whatever the substance may be, it's going to bring up our stuff too. And if we don't get the education as a family member to find out how we can help support, it's not about you better stop this or you're going to do this or, you know, that shame-based type motivation. You can never force somebody. But it's like, but as a family, it's important for families to keep themselves healthy also. But, you know, a lot of the, one of the biggest challenges I see in the field is that somebody goes through a program, they do very, very well, but they go back into an environment that's not very healthy. And so old behaviors are re-engaged, old coping mechanisms are re-engaged. And so, you know, there's this part that happens within a family, not all families, I'm not saying all families are like this, but it's like, that is your problem. You know, they're saying this to the person who has a substance use issue.
Yeah.
That is your problem. You are the problem. You go figure out your problem. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it would be nice if people, if families would actively engage and say, okay, when somebody in our family is dealing with a substance use issue, we then develop behaviors and habits in engaging with that individual. And so we need to make adjustments also for ourselves to keep our family healthy. That person's journey is their journey. But if we create a toxic environment, we're perpetuating this whole dynamic to occur once again. And so I think it's really important for families to realize, or people who love individuals who are dealing with substance use issues, that you also need to look at yourself. You may not be actively using, but you can have behaviors that can encourage that, that can push somebody. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, a person who is dealing with a substance use is going to blame somebody, but that is part of addiction, right?
Yeah.
Blame, those thinking errors, we've got all that going on. But you can see how this dance occurs. And I always like to use the term dance because it is a dance. It is a dynamic dance. Mm-hmm. Recovery is, substance use, the madness of substance use is, but we've all got it, and everybody that's involved in it needs to recognize that they need to have a level of understanding also.
Yeah.
You know, the person who's dealing with the substance has their journey. The family who is a part of that has their journey also, and they need to have healing. So those support communities, those supports, those people, you know, we need to learn not only how we talk, how we possibly marginalize, how we blame the individual, how we shame, how we try to guilt. So, you know, I think that's one of the biggest challenges when we start looking at harm reduction components, is because it's like, well, you should just stop. Like I stated before, you know, why can't you just stop? But it's like, I need to address my issues, because if I'm not offering support to that person on their journey,
something going on with you.
Then it's like, I'm gonna do, I may be an instigator. I don't know how many times I've had clients come in and it's like, well, my family, they're always questioning me. You know, are you high? Are you high? You were gone for 15 minutes longer than you were supposed to. What have you been doing? You have these different dynamics. And so families need to seek help. Families need to seek to understand also.
I love that you say families need to seek help, because it's so important that we acknowledge here that, you know, a loved one standing by, watching, you know, somebody they love a lot who is in active addiction or, you know, doing risky things, that's incredibly painful. You know, that's so hard to do. And so, I, you know, families need healing too. But it's like this beautiful dance, like Michelle said, we have to have this dynamic dance. Adam, I want to ask you what you think about this as well.
This whole time I've been thinking about Johann Hari's TED Talk, where he states that the opposite of addiction is connection. And that brings in the compassion component that Dr. Green was talking about. And then the whole time Michelle was speaking, it was acceptance was the word in my mind. Like, you have to accept that that person has a disease. You have to accept that maybe you contributed. And you have to accept that, yeah, it takes a village, basically, for that person to recover. It takes a community around that person for them to continue on that journey.
Gosh, thanks. So now let's think about the person who's in active addiction, you know, and somebody tells them that they need to just try harder, what would you tell them if they came, you know, Adam, if somebody came to you and said, I'm using right now and people just keep telling me that I just need to try harder and then I can stop using?
What would I say to that person?
Yeah, what would you do?
I would definitely give them my phone number and tell them anytime they needed a call, they could call me. Mm-hmm. But really, until that person's desire for life becomes stronger than their desire for drugs, there's nothing you can do to help them. So that person who is still trying to do that on their own with their own willpower, they're going to continue to fail until they can find something greater than them to keep them clean.
Thanks, Adam. Dr. Green, say that that person, they do have a desire to quit, or a desire to, like, even a 1% desire not to be using, but they find themselves relapsing, and they also hear, you know, people around them saying, you just need to try harder. Come on, like, get your crap together. What do you tell people when they come to you like that?
The more time that goes by, the more I think it's very important that people come to some of these realizations on their own. And so a lot of times I just present questions like, you know, well, how many times have you tried? And how many times do you feel like you gave it 100% effort? I don't think anyone's ever come in and talked to me and it was the first time that they had tried to stop using drugs. It's usually, you know, tens of times that they've tried to stop. They've given it a significant effort. Sometimes they've even managed to stop for weeks or months.
Yeah.
And then something happens that kind of drags them back. And so I think if you can get them to express, I have tried, I've given it my all, I've done it several times, sometimes it's almost worked and it just seems like it's outside of my grasp.
Yeah.
Then you can let them know there's help, right? There are other things that we can do to support you that can try to make up the difference between your efforts and success. And just like any chronic illness, it's going to take more than you. This is not something that you're going to be able to do on your own. You've tried several times already. And we talk about options.
That's not a bad thing.
No,
right?
It's fine. Yeah. And I think approaching it like other chronic illnesses and using descriptors like talking about, I talk a lot about hypertension because relapse rates for high blood pressure are somewhere in the 60%.
Wow.
But we don't get mad. We don't kick people out. We don't shame them. We don't withhold their medications from them. Mm-hmm. And we don't deny them access to treatment.
Yeah.
Even though their lack of hypertension control drives up healthcare costs and causes other diseases down the road, right? Mm-hmm. So I think if we have that discussion of this is bigger than you, this has become a medical illness, a medical emergency. You know, you really are at risk of dying. Yeah. We should be turning on the lights and sirens and ringing the bell to get help. We have to try somehow to foster that understanding that this is an emergency. This requires not just you and your doctor, but probably you and a team of treatment.
What does that team look like for you, Adam? And then Michelle, I'd really love to hear how that team looks like, you know, in your community as well.
So part of YPR is we're building a recovery-ready community, and that team involves everyone from law enforcement to harm reduction, like syringe exchange, because they have first contact with those people. For me personally, you know, I have a sponsor in my 12-step program that I can call and talk things out with. My support system, my family that I built those relationships back with, and then the relationship with my higher power, mm-hmm. and myself.
Yeah.
You know, I have to be willing to have that acceptance and openness and willingness to continue to learn and grow, because it's not about perfection, it's about progress. So that's my treatment team.
Wow. So you talked a little bit about your sponsor. Do you talk to this person often? Like,
yeah.
Do you keep a building relationship so that, you know, what does that sponsor look like? You know, that relationship look like?
So one of my favorite lines out of one of our readings is the therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel. So this guy's lived experience, and he's already done this recovery thing before me, helps me immensely because he's been there and done that with the things that I'm working through on my own personal level.
Yeah.
Which is how we learn everything else in life, right?
Yeah.
We find a mentor or a teacher who has already learned that, mastered that skill and done that to help us.
Yeah. Yeah, gosh, thanks. Such a good point. Michelle, what does the team look like for you? Like as a substance use counselor, is it only just you that's working with people or do you?
So working in the drug and alcohol field as a drug and alcohol counselor,
yeah.
Your time with an individual is not as lengthy as if it were a medical type of visit. So sometimes it's like 14 weeks, could be 14 visits. It could be every other week, you know, 7 visits. But I think within my experience, it's whatever the individual identifies, whoever they identify, whatever spiritual practice it may be, whatever group involvement it may be. And my position in this is to help them identify and help make those connections. So it's like if I'm talking to somebody, it's not my idea, you know, that's the best part about it. I'm not coming in and saying, okay, well, you need to talk, this is where you need to go there, and you need to go there. It's like, where do you feel you are going to get the support that you need in this part of your journey? Okay, now let's reach out, let's start establishing, let's talk about that. Is it helpful? What isn't helpful? You know, and so I love the individuality of it all. And it's, you know, whatever community they decide to be a part of, even like with family, there's a lot of people who are not involved with their, you know, their immediate family.
Yeah, of course.
They've created a separate family. And so, you know, a family of people that maybe are former users, people in recovery, somebody that was a childhood friend and they consider them more part of their family now.
Yeah.
So it's whatever's going to work, you know, whatever's going to work for that individual. But then it's important also to help them recognize when it isn't helpful.
Yes.
You know, when it is working. But then also to help them reframe, what is this going to look like?
Yeah.
So if somebody is actively using and they have that moment of clarity, or they're in a crisis and they're like, I need to stop. I want to stop. I was in the emergency room.
Yeah.
Or I had to have Narcan. It's like, okay, now what does this look like? Let's take that momentum and help you build what this is going to look like for you. And so it's helping an individual understand, to see, because if we keep things just in our thoughts, we have an idea of how this should look. Everybody does.
Yeah.
But now let's make it a tangent thing. Let's make it doable. Let's make it concrete.
Yeah.
Let's write it down. So there's all these different methods when you're working with somebody who is in a place where they're ready to move forward.
Yeah.
And even if their momentum carries them for maybe a month, it's like, all right, that worked for a month. Come back in. Let's see what worked. What could we do? What could you do? What helped? What didn't help? You know, just totally reassessing. And so
playing off of that, the dynamic journey of recovery,
yeah,
of using, of life, you know, everybody has a journey. And
yep, and everybody has, like, and other, you know, what works for one may not work for the other.
Yeah.
But yeah, sometimes we narrow our thinking in that there's only one pathway.
Yeah.
There's only one way to deal with people or help people who are using substances. But there's so many ways. It's so multifaceted. And so
you need to take multifaceted,
yes,
approach, which
you
is the whole
to.
Point of,
yeah,
this.
Yeah, not everybody needs to see an infectious disease doctor for treatment of HIV, right? Just the ones who have HIV.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Dr. Green, what does your team look like?
In my office, treatment usually starts with myself. And we've set it up that way because if we can use medications to help stabilize and ease discomfort early on, the chances that the patient continues to come back and makes it for their second, third, fourth, fifth appointment go way up. So they'll usually start with me, and then next they'll meet a case manager who really is in charge of making sure that they have everything they need to accomplish their goals. So she can help with education, finding job, finding housing, finding a therapist if we need one outside of my office, finding specialists. She'll help with anything.
Wow.
And then we have a therapist as well. We build on that in the community. We try to make sure that everybody's involved with some type of peer support group, whether it's a 12-step style group or something similar. And then if we need something like an infectious disease doctor or hepatologist. Mm-hmm. We work pretty closely with some of the bigger health systems around.
So you take this initial assessment and then you work with that patient so that you can find something that works for them.
That's right.
That whole team.
And we each have our own role. My role is kind of, I try to make the most extensive list I can of known issues and make sure that each one is being addressed appropriately. And then we have the case manager that takes on a lot of the social factors. Mm-hmm. And then we have a therapist that tries to kind of coach them in their emotional journey.
Yeah. So thanks so much. Michelle, are there any aspects of this myth that play out uniquely in tribal communities?
So let me just clarify, I'm not an expert. I am a tribal member, and so, you know, born and raised in my on the reservation and work, that's where I solely work.
Yeah.
And so I think within tribal communities, you know, there's always the stereotype that it's, you know, with alcohol or with substance use, that Native people are always, you know, that's where they, you know, you're a drunk Native.
Michelle is rolling her eyes right now.
Yeah, if you could see my facial expressions, you know, and so I think some of the biggest challenges in our tribal communities are the stereotypes. And so finding outside support groups, you know, we have NA, there's AA, but there's also Wellbriety. I love Wellbriety. Wellbriety is designed for Native American people through Native American concepts. So like back at home, part of our, in our residential treatment program, part of what we offer is a sweat. So, you know, and it's not just for tribal members. We have non-tribal people that.
So what is a sweat though?
So a sweat lodge.
Tell us a little bit about
what a sweat is, I can give you some information about Sweat Lodge. Yeah. So Sweat Lodge is it's a lodge where you go in. It's a closed area. There's a fire. There's rocks. There's there's ceremonial things that can happen. You know, prayers and stuff. Yeah. So it's an opportunity for people to exercise their spiritual beliefs.
Yeah,
and it's a good experience. So we offer that, and that works for some. And, you know, we have non-Native people that want to participate, so they're allowed, you know, they participate with that. But within tribal communities, sometimes you go into an environment that you're not used to, and there, you know, some people can be very opinionated. There can, you know, people can feel not connected. And so if there's not that connection with a group,
which is huge, is what Adam is and Dr. Green have been talking about.
Then it kind of defeats the purpose, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I just think there's just within our tribal communities, you know, we've got a lot of different programs. There's a lot of different ways for people to find that holistic approach that they need. To work on their spiritual, their physical, their mental and emotional components to find that balance.
Yeah.
And, you know, within their culture.
Beautiful. Thanks. Okay. We are over time, but I have to ask this one last question. In a perfect world where they knew this myth was wrong, you know, that addiction can just be overcome by willpower, and we focused on harm reduction and compassion when people have an addiction or any chronic illness for that matter, what do you think it would look like?
Hugs. I mean, I don't think, you know, I've ever spoken with a close friend or family member who let me know they had a new or problematic medical condition that was life-changing that I didn't hug and tell them that I was sorry and ask if I could help.
Yeah. Adam, what do you think?
I think it would probably look a little like Portugal. Like they're using the money they spent fighting that to help better these people's lives.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's so important, right? Because we know that one of the, if not the most important thing to recovery is healthy relationships.
Yeah.
Meaningful relationships, love. But our approach to substance abuse is isolation, right? If you get in trouble with the law, you're locked up, you're isolated.
Taken from your family.
That's right.
Your support group.
If your family decides to help you, usually it involves an intervention that isolates you from the rest of the family. if you decide to enter treatment, a lot of times it's a facility that isolates you from the rest of society. And that just doesn't work.
Yeah. So we need to change something.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
We need to be more like Portugal.
Yeah, we do. So it's funny. I have to say this. When Adam was saying we need to be more like Portugal and use that money, you know, to help people instead of locking them up, one of our editorial board members, Hillary, who flew in from Philadelphia today, is sitting in the room just fist pumping, cheering silently.
Yes.
As are all of us, because that's a compassionate approach. That's a harm reduction approach.
Yes.
Right? We're all about harm reduction.
Yeah.
The Debunked Podcast is made possible by our members and the Tribal and Rural Opioid Initiative of Utah State University, an effort to address opioid use among rural Utahns in the hopes of eliminating myths and promoting health. Information at khs.usu.edu/outreach. Thank you for joining us today on Debunked, the only Utah podcast combining evidence-based health practices with storytelling to challenge the stereotypes and debunk the myths about harm reduction, opioids, and substance use disorders. I'm Tim Light, and today we debunked the myth that addiction can be cured if you have enough willpower. Join us for episode 6 on June 10th, where we will be debunking the myth that Native Americans have a genetic predisposition to addiction. On today's episode, we talked about how, like any chronic illness, it takes a multifaceted approach to treat addiction. We talked about medication for addiction treatment, or MAT. We heard personal journeys of healing and some key components to those journeys. And we ended with compassion, because harm reduction is all about compassion. You can find links to the resources mentioned in this episode on our social media platforms at DebunkedPod. Speaking of social media, check us out on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube at DebunkedPod, or on our website at bit.ly/debunkedpod. Don't forget to tell all your friends about Debunked, and remind them that they can find the show on the podcast app Spotify, upr.org, and anywhere else they get their podcasts. Debunked is produced in collaboration with Utah Public Radio. Funding for the show comes from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, the Office of Health Equity and Community Engagement, the Utah State University Department of Kinesiology and Health Sciences, and Regions Blue Cross Blue Shield. Our editorial board is Jay Hymus, Adam Baxter, Ashanti Mortz, Savannah Ely, Dr. Sandra Solzer, Dr. Suzanne Previdel, Dr. Aaron Fanning Madden, Mindy Vincent, Patrick Rizak, Michelle Chapuz, Dr. Marin Voss, Dr. Amy Kahn, Trisha Glass, Lloyd Arrive, Hillary Deesh, and Susie Baker. Debunked is produced by Nick Porath, Shalane Smith Needham, and Friend Weller, with Nick Porath serving as lead producer. Our creative specialist is Autumn Gibbs. Music for today's episode was created by Nick Porath. Our science advisor is Dr. Aaron Fanning Madden, and our program directors are Dr. Sandra Solzer and Dr. Suzanne Previdel. I'm Tim Light, host and editorial board member.